welcome allies to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So here we are, diving to the winter solstice, the longest night, the depth of the dark, and all of its positive and negative ambiguity. So I'll be coming out to California for the winter solstice because it is the place of gathering force. If we want to influence the world, I think it's what's cooking now. So on December 20th at 7 p.m., I'll be talking at Open Secret Bookstore in San Rafael. The theme is Scheherazade Saves the World, a talk to celebrate the winter solstice story of 2001, deep delving to the still point at the heart of creation to become increasingly effective players on the team of creation. And then the next night, 8 p.m. Friday, December 21st, I'll be in Oakland at the First Congregational Church of Oakland, 27th and Harris Streets, 8 p.m., doors open at 7 p.m. If you want reservations for the solstice itself, December 21st, you can call my number 1-888-741-GODS, G-O-D-S. And if you want reservations for Open Secret, you call them. And there we have it. Also, we'll be needing volunteers on December 21st. If people want to come help and get in for free, you can call wonderful, admirable Russ Jennings at Russ Jennings Productions, 510-601-8008, if you'd like to volunteer. And we'll be posting all this on the website as well. So right this moment, Mars and Uranus, the heroic, and the Uranus, the principle of rebellion, intuition, innovation, democracy, equality, is rising due east. And it's both a description and an instruction. We know there's been rebellion lately against Osama bin Ashcroft. Just recently, in yesterday's Washington Post, Portland, Oregon police announced last week that they would not help the Justice Department, saying state law prohibits the question of immigrants not suspected of a crime. A spokesman said today, no interviews have taken place while Portland awaits a ruling from the state attorney general. So, yes, conservatives and others giving Osama bin Ashcroft a hard time in Congress. FBI has its carnivore, of course. They also have its magic lantern program coming down the line. Magic lantern allows unannounced intrusion into email whereby they can record every keystroke. They say that they need that so they can break those nasty codes. But as a friend of mine said, well, you know what, they have all this information, but there is a ruling incompetence, all this flooding. I thought it was interesting also when Bush was quoting Ashcroft about why the names of the detainees could not be revealed. And he said, well, it might hurt them. Yeah, that's it. There might be a backlash. Right, it might help Osama bin Laden. Well, I thought that that's a phrase that could enter the vernacular, you know, anything we don't want to do. We could go, I'd like to go to the movies with you, but it might help Osama bin Laden. I'd like to tell you the cost of lettuce, but it might help Osama bin Laden. So here we are. There's also much humor on the Internet. One of my favorite sites is bushwatch.com. Really excellent for many serious things, but they also have the Borowitz Report, which is necessary and useful, too. They suggest, the Borowitz Report suggests, that coming down the line is the combination of Cipro and Prozac. Ciprozac for everyone, probably mandatory. And they also have a, you know, cute thing. FBI warns that new contradictory warnings could be imminent. Bureau says latest statement may not be of concern. In a highly alarming yet confusing statement released today, the Federal Bureau of Investigation warned the American people to expect additional contradictory warnings from the FBI in the days ahead. Quote, the American people can expect the FBI to release several worrisome, unhelpful warnings in the next 72 hours, the statement read, or not. The FBI went on to say that while Americans should go about their business as normal, they should at the same time, quote, be prepared at all times to become jittery, anxious, and rattled by any contradictory statements the FBI might make. I don't know how many of you read the sort of late, great sort of 70s trilogy, the Illuminatus trilogy, but it had a useful concept in it, too, which was the idea that we're all programmed at birth to hear but not know that we hear the word fenord, and that it would produce enormous anxiety. So Dan Rather would come on the news and go, good evening, fenord. Anyway, so it is like that. We do want to be reading science fiction just to keep up with everything. It goes on, just cute article. Charles Holt, spokesman, says, we want to make it very clear at this time that we do not know what form our future warnings may take, other than to say that they will be very scary and useless. Holt said, having said that, I want to assure the American people that I did not really mean what I just said. Holt urged Americans to remain calm, but added that they should also be panicky and alarmed to the point of distraction, or not. The FBI spokesman added that frightening, unhelpful warnings from the FBI may very well become a way of life in America, but that that could change. Seizing on this remark, reporters asked Holt if he foresaw a time when the FBI might start issuing clear, helpful warnings to the public. Yes and no, Holt said. They also go on, they have a good article, Everyone in America Agrees on Everything Survey Says. So it is so complex, and you know, and there are so many players on the board that I thought how crucial it is to have this week's guest, our teammate Daniel Sheehan, with us to help us sort it out when our minds are numb with Carlyle Group. Frank Carlucci, wait, he was the roommate of Donald Rumsfeld at Yale. Wait, we need a weather map. It's all the old guys. It's Bud McFarlane. They're all back. So most of us, I think, know Daniel Sheehan. I knew his work most in Washington, D.C., when he also was a resident of this spiritual hardship post, and I'm still holding the fort, I think, and running the Christic Institute. I'd mentioned to him also, too, that when my mom was dying in 1988, and she was a medium liberal, but on the conservative side of things, but we watched the excellent Christic Institute video on the Iran-Contra and all the players, the secret team, and she was like, it brought her back to life, I think, for another 3 weeks. She rose out of coma going, yeah, go, whoever this guy Daniel Sheehan is, he's good. Get those guys. Get him. So there are many more grown-up ways to introduce Daniel Sheehan, but really, why bother? Let's just bring him on. Welcome, Daniel.
Good evening. Good afternoon, Caroline.
Yeah, so let's see. Here we are. There are so many players. You mentioned to me also, too, that last week Elliot Abrams had a new post, and I was like, wait, I missed that. Remind us what is his new post and why that's a really bad joke.
Well, Elliot Abrams has been appointed by George Bush Jr. to be the Assistant United States Ambassador for Human Rights, which is a total scream because he used to be the Assistant Secretary of State for Latin America all during the Iran-Contra scandals and was instrumental in helping to supervise one of the most major campaigns and violations of human rights in many decades, and was actually indicted by the special prosecutor, the Iran-Contra special prosecutor, Lawrence Walsh, for lying openly to committing perjury, actually in testimony against me. I was called to testify, the first one to testify in front of the United States Congress. I testified in front of the House of Representatives Subcommittee on Western Hemisphere Affairs in front of Michael Barnes, and provided the testimony explaining to them who was behind the Hassenfuss aircraft and what the whole network of people was. And Elliot Abrams came on in under oath, testified there was no such enterprise, that they had nothing to do with it, the White House knew nothing about this whatsoever, and was later indicted for his perjury in that case, which of course was the least of a whole series of offenses that he committed.
So there are so many bad jokes. I suppose we can think that maybe, and where we want to sort of tip this thing too, is that it's the incompetence of the people who are rising, or maybe you want to address that. I don't know if you do think they're incompetent, but in the sense of even the things that the Justice Department wants to do may well swamp them in useless information, yeah?
Well, it's interesting. With the computers that they have now and the ability to segregate and isolate information into the categories that they want, I'm afraid that that isn't going to do us that much good just to give them more and more information. I've always taken the position ever since doing the Karen Silkwood case and others back then when we found out that they had us under electronic surveillance, what we said is the more they know, the you know, less harm it does to us. Because the more they know, the more they end up realizing that it's loyal Americans who are just totally outraged at what they're doing and have come to get them. And so that tends to be undermining to them because they spend a substantial portion of their time trying to figure out what communist conspiracy is behind this, or how we're related to Cuba, or how we're, you know, financed from the Kremlin or something. And it turns out the deeper they delve into it, the more they discover that it's us, the citizens of the United States, that are outraged against what they're doing.
So you'd mentioned before that we're basically in the fourth George Bush administration.
Yes.
Yeah, and I guess I think, you know, it's when we look at the cast of characters, we could say, oh, no, they're back, you know, or in a sense they never went away. I mean, but they were visible and then sort of blah, 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 went down to the bottom, and now they're kind of blah, 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 back up.
They just sort of stayed in the wings that, you know, if you go down the list of them now, as everyone knows, I think, and it's interesting when you just stay very calm and centered and just kind of set forth the data, virtually everyone knows that the major advisor to George Bush Jr. is George Bush Sr. you know, he's on the phone with him all day long. He basically wears one of those earplugs around, listening to him all day, you know, getting direct advice from his father. His father tries to not appear in public with him very often, because then everyone would say, wait a second, this is just a puppet regime. But the fact is, he speaks with him all the time, regularly, every day. And then, of course, George Bush Sr. put his former Secretary of Defense, Richard Cheney, into the position of vice president. And, of course, the vice president is always in some secret, undisclosed place running the whole operation. He's running the whole military operations against the Middle East. He's running the 5412 committee that runs all covert operations for the National Security Council. You know, it's clear that Richard Cheney is the legate for George Bush Sr. running the entire military operations. And, of course, Colin Powell, who was the chief of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, military staff, for George Sr., has been now made the Secretary of State for George Jr. And so with his father's Secretary of Defense on one side and his chief of military staff on the other side of him, you know, he just basically takes instructions. And now the assistant to Colin Powell has been made Richard Armitage. And Richard Armitage, of course, was instrumental, a key player in the whole Iran-Contra crisis. He was an assistant Secretary of Defense for Far Eastern Affairs, was intimately connected with Oliver North and Jack Singlaub and that entire group of people that actually ran the off-the-shelf operation for George Bush Sr. And Richard Armitage was actually it was one of the major reasons why Ross Perot, in fact, chose to run against George Bush Sr., because he was so outraged at the conduct that these people had been engaged in. And now Richard Perles is back. Richard Perle is on George Bush Jr.'s National Security Advisory Committee. You know, they refer to him as the Black Prince. He's just this total hard rock, right-wing kind of crypto-fascist in the middle of the whole operation. And Otto Reich has been brought back in now to be the Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs. And he's the one that ran the Office of deceiving all the American people. He ran the whole operation the propaganda arm of the North operation, the Iran-Contra conspiracy. You know, and it was the special prosecutor, Lawrence Walsh, again, you know, publicly revealed what Otto Reich was doing. You know, they got all the records of the Office of Public Diplomacy, and the Office of Public Diplomacy under the George Bush Sr. First two administrations, you know, were actually using major Pentagon psychological warfare operations against the American public. And this was fully reported by the special prosecutor, Lawrence Walsh. And yet back comes Otto Reich, and back comes Richard Perle, and back comes Richard Armitage, and, you know, and John Negroponte. Has been made George Bush Jr.'s ambassador to the United Nations. And Negroponte was, in fact, the ambassador to Honduras under the first two George Bush Sr. administrations. I refer to those. Those were the administrations that were publicly characterized as the Ronald Reagan administrations. But everybody, you know, in Washington, D.C., with a political IQ above room temperature, knows that, in fact, George Bush was running the entire operations in the Reagan administrations. That George Bush Sr. not only chaired the 5412 committee of all covert operations, which were instrumental to the entire Reagan administrations, but he also chaired the South Florida Drug Interdiction Task Force that allowed thousands of tons of cocaine to come pouring into the United States to fund the Contra weapons supply operations. He also chaired the special commission that redrafted all the rules for the savings and loan banks that ended up giving millions and millions of dollars of entirely unsecured loans to covert operations for Oliver North and Jack Singlaub. And so these people are a whole cadre. So you had the George Bush ran the first two administrations of Ronald Reagan, then ran his own administration from 88 to 92, and after a slight breather here to get them out of the crosshairs, because these people would have been indicted, you know, if they hadn't basically taken them off stage for a while. So they came off stage, and Clinton came on temporarily, and now they're back.
So, and they would have been indicted. They would have been indicted by whom?
They would have been indicted by the special prosecutor. Special prosecutor indicted the first round of people, and of course George Bush Sr. pardoned them all. But the fact of the matter was is that all of these people were still very much liable for a criminal prosecution because of the while the special prosecutor comes on and conducts the major investigation, they in fact could prosecute these people even though they're out of office. So these George Bush Sr., you know, was looking right down the gun barrel of a major federal criminal indictment. And so it was actually to his benefit that he didn't get reelected.
So how we tell the story, I mean, you know, in your most positive, intention really right now, too, might we think that they've come back up where we can actually, now they're visible and they can be indicted? And
well, no, actually, a substantial, now the statute of limitations has expired. You see that they have five-year statutes of limitations on most of those crimes that they were committing, the drug importation, the arms export control violations, the myriad of crimes that they committed under the Federal Criminal Racketeering Act, that there are 5-year statutes of limitations. So they basically stepped off the stage for a 5-year period, actually an 8-year period for the Clinton administrations, and as soon as the statutes of limitations have expired, they're back.
Yes. So what do you want us most to be concerned about, and what is the ideal scenario of what would happen, how this would play out?
Well, the problem is that what you have to look at is it's not the fact that they're back in and of itself isn't the worst of all of the situation. The worst situation is what it is that they're up to and what the plan is they've been engaged in for these many years since George Bush Sr. was the director of the Central Intelligence Agency back in 1976. You know, the fact of the matter is that these people are the power behind the throne of all of these people is the national security state bureaucracy, the operations director, the Central Intelligence Agency, the covert war, the low-intensity conflict operations that they engage in. And what they've been engaged in for the last 20 years is a stealth program to actually bring together the NAFTA nations, the United States, Canada, and Mexico, to join together with the GATT nations, the European Economic Community, the Northern European countries, to form a huge economic cartel and a major political alliance under the World Trade Organization with its own military, which is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. This gives them the power to function completely independently from the United Nations. So they go in and bomb away unilaterally, and then what they do is they say, well, we've completely destroyed Afghanistan, so let's now have the United Nations figure out how to put together some kind of a government there now that we've pulverized these people. You know, so that what they've done is they're following a script which has been laid out, and I would recommend that people, you know, run right out and steal this book, a book that was written by Samuel P. Huntington. Huntington is a major spokesperson for the Trilateral Commission's Council on Foreign Relations, and he's the president of the American Association of Political Science. Is also the director of the Olin Institute for International Policy at Harvard University. But he has written a book which is called The Clash of Civilizations. And what we see playing itself out here is a major clash between this new superstate that is really being covertly organized on the part of the northern powers, the United States and Canada and Mexico and the European countries of Great Britain and France and the new reunified Germany along with Italy. And, of course, now they're bringing China. Russia in.
China, yes.
Well, China isn't in yet because you got to understand the thing that all these other people have in common is that they're all Caucasian nations, basically.
But what about the timely addition to China to the WTO?
Well, that was interesting. On the 17th of September, they agreed to allow them to come in because they believe that they've started to mount their major campaign pursuant to Huntington's advice in the clash of civilizations in the remaking of the world order. He sets forth a specific recipe for how they should proceed. And what they should do first is to combine themselves all together into this big, huge super state that they're politically aligned under the World Trade Organization, which is like a super parliament, a legislature, that has the authority to actually set aside statutes of any of the sovereign nations that conflict with the objectives of the coalition in the World Trade Organization. And militarily, they come together under the NATO war powers group, and then they join together economically under NAFTA and GATT. And then, is that once they get fully solidified, what they then do is they begin to mount a major campaign to be able to their actual quote was, to maintain their continued privileged access to the strategic raw materials needed by the Northern Industrial Alliance. Now, this actual mission statement appears in a classified document that was actually written up by the Bush Senior administration in 1991 under the direct supervision of George Bush Senior and Colin Powell, then his chief of his Joint Chiefs of Staff. It's called The Projection of U.S. Military Power into the 21st Century and Beyond. And it specifically calls for the organization of this kind of new alliance with these people and states that the specific mission of this is to maintain continued privileged access to the Strategic Raw Material Alliance. And that mission statement is exactly what we see being rolled into place right now. What happened is that the attack of September 11th was in fact a preemptive strike that was undertaken by the Islamic world, because what Samuel Huntington asserted is that this major Caucasian Christian coalition of nations, he said, was actually had to set itself up as a major unified force to be able to oppose the rise of the Asian empire under China and the Islamic world. So he specifically identified the Asian empire in the Islamic world as being ultimate others that were not to be included in this new coalition. And so that what happened is the Islamic world didn't fail to understand what was going on. Everybody outside of the United States knows what's going on. They can see this thing forming up, and they were going to be garnering their forces to undertake an offensive operation to exploit all of the resources of Asia and of the Islamic world. Now, that's what's going on here. That is the stealth program of the Bush administration and the National Security State Forces through the operations director of the Central Intelligence Agency. And
how are we doing in foreign press, in the sense that the BBC also, you know, carried an article that said that Colin Powell had announced to Pakistan in mid-July that U.S. bombing of Afghanistan would begin in mid-October. So,
well, I would suggest that if one is going in the direction of kind of deepening this potential conspiracy, what one really needs to look to is the fact that the operations director under George Bush and the off-the-shelf enterprise of George Bush was run by Theodore Shackley. Theodore Shackley was the director of covert operations worldwide for George Bush Sr. when he was the director of the CIA, and he's the man that assembled the off-the-shelf enterprise. It wasn't Oliver North, and it wasn't Richard Secord or Jack Singlaub. The director of covert operations, Theodore Shackley, is a trainee of Reinhard Gehlen. Reinhard Gehlen was the Waffen-SS commander of all anti-Soviet and anti-Eastern Bloc intelligence gathering for the Third Reich. And his entire staff of almost 100 men were taken whole out of Germany at the end of World War II and were transplanted into running the intelligence services for West Germany. They were taken off the Nuremberg War Tribunal lists and actually put in to direct anti-Soviet intelligence for NATO for 26 years after World War II. And Theodore Shackley was the direct protege of Reinhard Gehlen. He served in Germany under Reinhard Gehlen from 1949 all the way to 1961, prior to his being brought back into the United States to run the CIA station in Miami against Cuba, and then was brought in to be the CIA station chief in Saigon and ran the entire covert operations in Southeast Asia, the Phoenix program, the massive smuggling of narcotics, the supporting of Vang Pao, the opium warlord there, and then transferred into Latin America to become the director of Western Hemisphere operations, overthrew Allende, supervised the overthrow of the Argentine government by the colonels, you know, fostered the violation of the human rights in Honduras and all through Latin America. This guy, Theodore Shackley, is the major domo here. He's the kind of Dr. Moriarty out behind the whole scene. And he, in fact, is the guy that basically runs George Bush Sr.
Really? So that's, okay, I have to just slow you down for a second, because it is one of those things like Fanord, because I hear the word Theodore Shackley and it's hard to hold on to.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why we need you, and that's why we need a weather map and a movie
that's
and a
right.
TV show, and I mean all kinds of things.
This is the map.
So say again. Yeah, okay. So Theodore Shackley is now where?
Theodore Shackley runs a thing called TGS Inc., Theodore G. Shackley Inc. It's a threat assessment group in Washington, D.C. It's a major anti-terrorist special advisory group in Washington, D.C., just outside of Washington, across the Key Bridge. And he hangs out there, and he runs this entire operation. All of these people are proteges of Theodore Shackley. Colin Powell is a protege of Richard Armitage. Richard Armitage is a protege of Theodore Shackley.
So can we have a family tree? I mean, are you going to do a poster?
It's a very simple one. The key to this is remembering that right toward the very end of World War II, that when the Germans realized that they weren't going to be able to win this, this guy Reinhard Gehlen, the commander-in-chief of the Waffen-SS anti-Soviet and anti-Eastern Bloc intelligence, photographed 17 barrels of microfilm of the documents of the Third Reich, and along with seven assistants, fled Germany, went up into the mountains of Bavaria, and buried these 17 barrels in the meadows up there, and waited for the war to get over. He then turned himself into the 101st Counterintelligence Corps of the United States Army when the war ended, and said, "I am Reinhard Gehlen. I am the commander of all anti-Soviet intelligence for the Third Reich. I will make a deal with you. You agree to take my name off the Nuremberg War Crime Tribunal, which he was on for having annihilated an entire town in Poland, for having not turned over the people who killed a German general. And he said, there's 100 other men I want taken off that list, and I will agree to run the entire anti-Soviet intelligence operations, which we already have in place for the Western world." And they came. He was brought to Washington, D.C., stayed at Fort Hood outside of Washington, D.C. for a full month, carried on negotiations there to get this deal cut. The deal was made, and both Republican and Democratic administrations joined in on this deal. And then he was sent back to Germany, and under West Germany, he ran the anti-Soviet and anti-Eastern Bloc intelligence operations for NATO for 26 years. But sitting directly under him was this young man, Theodore Shackley, who had been a Central Intelligence Agency operative. He had been in the Counterintelligence Corps as a translator, and he was sent to the very first class, the entering class of the Central Intelligence Agency in 1948, after the creation of the Central Intelligence Agency by the National Security Act of 1947. He was trained in the first group that came out and was sent to Germany, and he was trained at the NATO Special Anti-Communist Warfare Training Center at Oberammergau in the Bavarian Alps. And this place was run by Otto Skorzeny, who was the Waffen-SS commander of special warfare operations. And he was a hand-picked designate of Reinhard Gehlen. They trained 1,200 men at this place, at Oberammergau in Regensburg in the Bavarian Alps, between 1948 and 1961. And all of these men spread out into all of the national security agencies of all the NATO nations across the world. And these people are not just anti-communists. These people are Nazi-trained, you know, fascists is what they are. And that's why Shackley ended up ascending. You follow Shackley from there. When he was there from 1948 to 1961, and then he was brought back from Germany and became the CIA station chief in Miami to run the entire operations against Castro from 1961 to 1963. He, in fact, is the one who supervised the special assassination team that was put in the field to assassinate Castro, who has been named by the House Select Committee on Assassinations as the primary suspects for having killed President Kennedy. And they demanded that the investigation be conducted against them. Shackley was taken from there when the heat got on there. It was sent to Southeast Asia, where he became the deputy CIA station chief in Laos, and then the CIA station chief in Saigon. He assembled the entire Phoenix program, the massive program that killed over 200,000 noncombatant civilians. This is the man who was hand-picked by George Bush to be the director of the Central Intelligence Agency's covert operations worldwide in 1976, when George Bush was appointed the director of the CIA. Now, these people are in the woodwork. They're extraordinarily dangerous. They constitute a horizontal fraternity of men around the world who are vastly more loyal to each other horizontally than they are vertically to any government that they're a part of, because they're a hand-picked, trained group of 1,200 men trained by Otto Skorzeny.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll have a quiz when we come back, and so we can absorb all this information. Our guest today is the invaluable Daniel Sheehan. We do want to absorb this. I'm taking notes myself. You can join us after break at 510-848-4425, and we'll be right back.
Come, you masters of war. Here that build the big guns. Here that build the death planes.
This is not a live broadcast, so do not try to call in to talk with us. Ago, this was broadcast.
I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes. And you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won. You want me to believe.
Welcome back, allies, the Visionary Activist Show. I'm Caroline Casey. Our guest today is Daniel Sheehan, and he brings with him a whole bunch of spooks that we want to know about. It's crucial. You can join us again, 510-848-4425. Also, for a copy of this show, which I will need, too, you can call 1-888-741-GODS, G-O-D-S. I was trying to tear sheets of paper off without making it sound like I was. Yes, so, of course, everything was... And remind us once again... Theodore Shackley is now currently where?
He's in Washington, D.C., running TGS, Inc., a threat assessment institute. It's a special anti-terrorist security company where he stays there and is outside of the reach of any of the investigations of government authorities and constitutional investigations. He runs the private operation, but he is the guy who is behind all of these people and is their major their major mentor.
So, of course, when we talk about loss of civil liberties and the increasingly expanding and loose definition of terrorism, it does include certainly anti-globalization activists and such.
Well, it's interesting. Their view, the attempt that they made was that when the Soviet Union started to fade as their major adversary, they started to raise up this entire brand name of terrorism as the major opponent. These people are dialecticians. They're primary followers of Hegel and Nietzsche, and they believe in dialectics. They draw their energy from this dialectical confrontation of A versus B. So they have to have these big boogeymen. You know, they're constantly putting the targets out. You know, the pictures of their main bad guy of the month, Saddam Hussein or Gaddafi, or whether it's the Ayatollah. You know, and now it's Osama bin Laden. They've got to have some major bad guy to deal with. But the fact of the matter is, this designation as terrorists is, you got to remember that back when we filed a major federal lawsuit against all of these people back in 1984, back in 1986, we actually technically filed it. We started the investigation in 84. We named all of these people and laid them out in a federal court lawsuit and were willing to put the evidence forth in court against these people. And Jack Singlaub, who was to refresh people's recollection, Jack Singlaub was the commanding major general of all U.S. military forces in South Korea and was fired by Jimmy Carter because of Singlaub's condemning the president for not being more aggressive against North Vietnam. And he became the president of the World Anti-Communist League, which is, there's a great book out called Inside the League, and it's by Scott Anderson. People can get that and see who these people are. But they designated the Christic Institute that, came from the Jesuit National Headquarters and had all 54 major religious denominations in the country basically support. They designated us as terrorists because we filed this major lawsuit against them and proceeded to present evidence against them in a federal court. So it's perfectly clear that they perceived us as terrorists. And so that the people who are critics of their major policies, you know, they're going to try to put all of these things into place, saying, you don't need to worry about this stuff because it's only against foreign nationals. But all they have to do is just lift that designation out of the statute and repass it, and it applies to everybody. And this is just exactly how it was done in Germany. It's not ironic, as you can tell from my discussion with you prior to the break, that this is the exact policies that were followed in Germany in the 1920s. They first started designating Jews as the major source of the problem. Then it spread out to unionists, trade unionists. Then it spread out to gypsies. And then it spread out to anybody that opposed the Third Reich. That this is there's a blueprint for this thing. And what we see happening here, people are standing there kind of like deer in the headlights, watching these things with military tribunals being authorized to try people with no probable cause to believe they committed any crime. They can be swept off the street. They can be held at without any designation as to what they're being held for. There's no judicial supervision of this. They can, in fact, be held with a simple signature of the Attorney General for an open-ended period of time, renewed every 30 days by his signature. They are not tried. They're not tried by civil judges. There's no appeal to any civil court from any conviction by the military tribunal. The federal rules of civil procedure and federal rules of criminal procedure do not apply. The code of military justice doesn't even apply. The tribunals are allowed to make up their own rules of procedure, which include concealing from you the major witnesses who are testifying against you, and even concealing from you the evidence that, in fact, is put together to prosecute you. And you have no right to counsel. I mean, this is as stark as anybody could possibly imagine. You know, if people can't see this coming, then they might as well have lived back in the 1920s in Germany and said there was nothing wrong.
But once again, also, I mean, foreign governments are going, we're not going to hand anybody over to you. You know, I know no suspects, no nothing.
Well, but they don't care. They'll go get them. You know what I mean? That's what the Delta Force is for. They'll drop in the Marines and get them.
And let me also ask you too about Putin. But I'm going to say two sentences first. In terms of where Putin fits in, I don't know if you heard the sort of extraordinary and chilling live call-in radio show that Putin did.
I knew he had it, but I didn't hear it.
Well, it was amazing. I mean, on one level, I mean, what an interesting reptile being. But on one level, you go, oh, like a smart leader. We haven't heard that.
A guy who can talk English.
But he can't. Oh, yes, exactly. Well, it was being translated, but complex, shape-shifting, smart, serpentine, subtle, extraordinary.
Yeah.
But he also, one of the things that was spooky, I mean, many things. He said, oh, yes, we need our dissidents. Somebody asked him about Solzhenitsyn. He said, yes, the state sometimes is blind and we need our, it was like, whoa. But he also said, we, of course, in Russia feel tremendous empathy for you because we, too, have had our terrorist bombing in Russia, in Moscow, and the apartment buildings were innocent people. Well, anyway, so I was talking to one of the guys who was a writer of the Al-Qaeda document, and he said, do you know the term sparkle? And I said, no, what's that? And he said, it's when covert operations stage something, in order. He said, the people, it was not the Chechens who bombed Moscow, it was KGB.
Yeah,
it was
Putin. Agents provocateur.
Exactly. It was Putin. He said, because one, it stopped. You know, they didn't have the finances to. I mean, it was clearly KGB. So there was Putin again, the wily, interesting, saying, oh, we so feel for you for things that I have done. Anyway, so spooky. But, yes. Well, let's bring patient first caller Joe in Sonoma in. Joe, come in.
Oh, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe.
I was curious. In the beginning, you said that you thought it was the Arab states or Afghanis or something who were engaged in a preemptive strike on the World Trade Center.
Mm.
And when I think of a preemptive strike, I thought, well, you know, what advantage did that concur to the Islam nations to hit the World Trade Centers when all the pretext that the Bush administration ever wanted in their greatest dream?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Was for them to hit here, and they can go and say, okay, it's terrorism, we have to take over the world. So
mm-hmm.
I don't really know if I agree on that. And then the second point, and I'll just let you answer when I leave, is I haven't seen too much evidence against Osama bin Laden or anyone.
I know.
So
let me respond to that. Yeah, I don't support Mike Rupert and other people's assertions that that this may have been like another Reichstag fire or a thing that was actually supervised covertly by the Central Intelligence Agency to instigate this incident so that they could have all this justification for, you know, waging war against the Islamic world. I think that, that if you know Theodore Shackley and his people, you know perfectly well that he's a genius. I mean, this man is a genius. He knows perfectly well what the motivations are of other people. They knew perfectly well that the way that they were going and the of moving in and putting the military troops in Saudi Arabia, supporting the House of Saud, you know, with their golden toilets and their diamond-studded mirrors in their house while everybody else in their country lives in starvation. Same way with the Kuwaiti royal family, the propping up those kind of totalitarian governments, that they knew that the people, that the Islamic fundamentalists were rising and training to come do something. And the fact is, they didn't have to instigate those people to do this. These people realized that this major coalition of the Northern Industrial Alliance was coming together, was forming up under the World Trade Organization, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank. You know, they could see this coming. The G8 was right on the horizon. It was expanding out from the G7 to include now Russia. And you remember, they didn't have Russia come into any of this stuff until after Russia had spun off what they call the ethnic provinces, which included, of course, Asian people and Islamic people. And so that Russia now just constitutes primarily Mother Russia, the primarily Caucasian state, and they're being brought in now as the eighth partner in the major Northern Industrial Alliance. And the Islamic world could see that happening. And it was the oil of the Islamic world that was deemed by the Northern Industrial Alliance to be a, quote, strategic raw material that they needed to have, quote, privileged access to. So they had the exclusive leases on all of that property, all that oil in the Middle East, and they were given the right to take it out and to maintain oil here at $1.50 to $1.70 or something a barrel, where it's extraordinarily expensive other places in the world. And they view themselves as entitled to have this, because you need to understand, this is the same exact worldview that obtained. Now, it's going to get a little sophisticated, but it's the same exact worldview that obtained at the end of the 19th century. This white man's burden, the manifest destiny, the right of the Caucasian northern states to exploit the resources of all the aboriginal people of the world, it was the primary operative thesis that flowed out of Hegel's writings and Nietzsche's writings about the Übermensch. And it became the operative thesis of world organizing on the part of the Western nations. It was only the rise of the antithesis of world communism in Marx that challenged that. What we have seen for the last 75 years, basically, since 1917, all the way up until 1991, was the primary struggle between the thesis of Caucasian state capitalism and this worldwide non-Caucasian world communism. And the simple fact is that as of December 21st of 1991, the antithesis lost. And what happened is the Western powers just basically returned to their basic pre-dialectic thesis of world capitalism. And it was, in fact, a racially motivated, superior theory of organizing on the planet. And that was not missed by the Islamic world. They see that this Northern Industrial Alliance is planning to siphon all the oil out of their country. And now
But Joe's point that this was preemptive doesn't make logical sense.
Well, no, preemptive. When they say, look, when you have a people realizing that they are getting set to be basically subsumed by Western civilization, and that the faster that you can try to strike back in some way against them before they get fully aligned, the better it is. Now, I'm not saying they were wise in doing it by any stretch of the imagination, but when people keep saying, gee, why'd they do this to us? Why do they dislike us? You know, in the best that Bush Jr. can come up with is they don't like freedom, they don't like democracy. You know, that's crazy. The fact of the matter is that we're in pillaging the resources of their whole area of the world, and their people are living in grinding poverty under the regimes of these sultanates that are kept in power by United States military forces sitting in their country.
So several miles back, were you also thinking that intelligence knew this was happening and was like,
oh, yes,
we'll just let the thing happen?
It wasn't necessary for them to know precisely where or precisely which one. It doesn't require that. They knew that these people were planning to do something, and what you saw was they had a full panoply of things prepared. So when, in fact, it happened, they all of a sudden appear at 3:15 in the morning on the floor of the United States Congress with an omnibus anti-terrorism bill, and they appear with an omnibus economic stimulation bill. You know, and all these things are in place. It doesn't require them having planned it. It doesn't require them having instigated it. They knew perfectly well that something was going to happen. Now, I don't think in 100 years they imagined the scale of what it was going to be. You know, because it shocked everybody, including themselves. But the fact of the matter is that it gave them, as Joe points out, the perfect opportunity to roll into place an accelerated joining together of all of these major allies that they wanted to have in power. So what we've seen happen here is there is a return to the 19th century organizing principle or paradigm of worldwide Caucasian state capitalism. This is primarily racial and economic, and they're establishing economic and military and racial hegemony over the whole world. And if you read Samuel Huntington's book, you will see that he points out, he said that what we've got to do is we've got to put a stop inside Western civilization to all of this multiculturalism and all of this racial mixing, he says, that this is a Christian country, a Christian nation, and the whole Western world is Christian, and it's basically Caucasian. And he just says it. And it's one of the most astonishing books, and it was published, the initial article was published in Foreign Affairs magazine, the most prestigious foreign affairs magazine in the country. And so people need to go read this, just like Mein Kampf. You know, they said it before they did it.
Okay, and the book is called The Clash of Civilizations.
The Clash of Civilizations and the Remaking of World Order.
Ah, now we'll bring in Lucian Fremont, who I'm sure is a scholar of Hegel and Nietzsche. Come in, Lucia.
Yeah, absolutely.
There you go.
Fabulous discussion. I'm really glad to hear Daniel again. Heard you earlier this month at New Science and Ancient Wisdom in Berkeley.
Ah, right.
I'm on the board of the organization that puts that on, and we were really happy to have you there. And I'd like you to discuss the implications here on the national security state of the extraterrestrial presence, and if you could discuss the Disclosure Project. And I'd like to encourage Caroline to get Stephen Greer to come on your show and talk about the Disclosure Project, because all of this is very related. And I'll take
okay.
Stephen.
Well, what we have in front of us right now, of course, is the as you pointed out, Caroline, and Joe pointed out, is kind of the dream world for the anti-terrorists, for the national security state people. They have here in front of them a terrorist attack, you know, on the heart of America, as they refer to it, and it's given them the justification for energizing themselves as dialecticians to try to crush all of the Islamic terrorist organizations. We know perfectly well that they're getting ready to go after Saddam Hussein, going into Iraq after this. They're going to go into Somalia. They're going to then go after Gaddafi in Libya. They're going to try to crush all of these potential military threats against their...
Yeah. No, you go. Okay, you finish.
Well, the point is that this has been predicted. Wernher von Braun, who was the head of the U.S. space program for NASA for many, many years, pointed out in discussions before he died, he said, look, what you're going to see these people do is they're going to be in this major dialectical contest with Russia until they vanquish Russia. And then they're going to start announcing that they're terrorists, that they have to really stop. And they will go after the people in the Islamic world under the rubric of terrorism. And then they're going to go after China as their major adversary, because what they're going after is a worldwide national security state, and they need to constantly justify themselves with this ultimate other, this ultimate threat that they've got going. And what the woman has just made reference to is a comment I made in the speech I gave over there, over at Berkeley here a couple weeks ago. I said what Wernher von Braun said is that once they get control of the resources of the planet in all of the military and governmental institutions of the planet, then they're going to have the problem of having no ultimate enemy to continue to justify the repression of civil rights and all of that. And the next one online, he said, would be their announcement that they had discovered the existence of an extraterrestrial civilization, and that this extraterrestrial civilization was a major threat to the planetary government, and therefore they had to continue to spend $300 to $500 billion a year in military preparations and start to build a major military shield around the planet, etc. These people live off this dialectic energy, and they need to have it. Now we're quite some stages from that right now, because they're just working at the terrorist phase of this right now.
Yeah,
China
that
is next.
That could take a long time, because the other side, I mean, we do, this is all important and true, and there's a million stories going on at once as well. And from the other side, though, in a sense, I mean, Osama bin Laden, I do think, is a fairly long-term thinker as well. And also, isn't it also in his design that, yes, come bomb Iraq, come, you know, absolutely create the jihad for me, whereby we can have an Islamic versus the West jihad face-off war.
Well, they've been trying to instigate
we'll nuke
that.
The oil if necessary. What?
They're trying to instigate that. There's no doubt about that. I mean, a person who is kind of a messianic character, such as Osama bin Laden, you know, the worst thing in the world that can happen to them is to be ignored, and to have his, you know, poster up in every post office in the Western world, and to be designated as the ultimate enemy, and to be instigating people to the jihad, you know, is his dream. And now you've got the people in Bush's national security state. They're having their dream, too. The problem is, Caroline, this is a bad dream. This is a dream. This is the dream that ends in apocalypse. This is the dream that ends with the bombing, you know, the firebombing of the end times. And that is a dream, but it's a real one, and it can be played out. It's a major archetype that resides deep in the unconscious of our human family, that if we're not able to overcome this archetype and replace it with a new paradigm of peacefulness and in the productive development of resources in our galaxy and other places, you know, we in fact will self-terminate. And that's what we see threatened right here.
Yeah. And also, what Lucia was bringing up, the Disclosure Project, you are the lawyer for the Disclosure Project.
Yes, I'm general counsel for that.
And in what capacity? Defending whom against whom?
No, it's just general counsel for the organization. What we did we in fact, sponsored a major press conference back in May or June, I believe it was, in Washington, D.C. at the National Press Club, where we had 20 major government officials, and people such as the director of all investigations for the FAA, the Federal Aviation Agency, you know, major colonels in the military, et cetera, who all testified in open conference to the press corps about their having direct knowledge that, in fact, the United States knows about the existence of an extraterrestrial civilization, and that they've been ordered not to talk about this. And the people were worried from a First Amendment point of view that if they came forward and revealed this, that they might be retaliated against, their retirement benefits from the military would be taken away, etc. And so I was contacted by Stephen Greer, the director of the Disclosure Project, to come in to advise these people, to provide legal counsel for them if, in fact, they were retaliated against.
And your thought, or Stephen Greer's thought, or both, is that this is a scam on the part of the government to create the illusion of extraterrestrial civilization, or we don't know?
No, it's we don't know until there's a full-scale professional investigation. What the Christic Institute was able to provide over the years, until George Bush Sr. revoked our 501c3 tax-exempt charter for filing the major Iran-Contra lawsuit against them, that what we did is we provided the solid, step-by-step professional investigation of the rumors and the concerns that our generation had about something going on that was nefarious, whether it was Karen Silkwood being killed and really investigating it to find out who killed her and why, or the people that were killed down in Greensboro to find out who was behind all of that. You know, these types of investigations are the things that we do. And until such time as there's a major private investigation conducted by ourselves as civilians of what the truth of the matter is with regard to the Roswell incident and the other incidents that go on, we aren't going to be able to know. But we do know that the government, the Office of Public Diplomacy with Otto Reich and the people, are perfectly capable of completely fabricating information to try to generate and continue this dialectic by means of which they justify the national security state apparatus.
Good. Let's go to our next caller, whose name has escaped into the ethers. Next caller. Who is the next caller? Noel. Noel, come in.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, Noel.
My radio down. Hi. This is a great show. I'm still reeling from the November elections.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, it's almost silly to ask, it's all pretty obvious, but I was wondering what your thoughts and how you would have described the details of the masterminding of that.
Well, it's interesting. I think that what we're really seeing here with the placement of 7 of the 9 justices on the United States Supreme Court being appointed by Ronald Reagan, George Bush, and Richard Nixon, you know, these are not normal conservatives. These are ideologues that have a specific worldview. And they do not, in fact, believe in 3/4 of the things they say about states' rights or, you know, individual liberties or anything. They actually profess the ideology of the Federalist Society. The Federalist Society is this kind of semi-secret group in Washington, D.C., that is chaired by Orrin Hatch, who is the former chairman of the Judiciary Committee of the United States Senate, and Robert Bork, the former nominee of Ronald Reagan to the Supreme Court. These people are total reactionaries. You can find out about them if you look at hard enough. You can find out about the Federalist Society, that these people are the people behind the entire choreographing of the taking over of the legal institutions in the United States. That they want to appoint 100 federal judges from the Federalist Society to fill all the federal judicial vacancies that are presently there. And they've now got Ashcroft in the Justice Department. In the Judicial Search Committee, of the 10 lawyers that were in the Judicial Search Committee for the Justice Department, 8 of them were members of the Federalist Society. That what we see is that people on the Supreme Court, like Scalia and Rehnquist and these people, these are right-wing ideologues. And when it came to the point of having an opportunity to put George Bush's son back in power, you saw what they did is they basically scuttled all of their professed beliefs in states' rights, all of their beliefs in non-judicial activism, all of their beliefs with regard to the separation of powers, and they moved right in and they flushed all that stuff down the toilet and designated George Bush Jr. to be the president of the United States. Now, the worst, that's just to be expected. That's how they are. But the fact that the Democratic Party and Gore acted the way they did, and just what threw their hands up and went, I guess they lost. You know, you saw that spectacle, and when they were actually counting the votes, you know, Gore stood up and gaveled down no less than 8 congresspeople that insisted upon having a thorough investigation of the vote count in Florida.
He did.
And
he wouldn't allow it. Yeah, he lost everybody then.
He wouldn't allow it.
Even his diehard people had stuck with him for the incompetence.
And he just said, no, it's more important to have the alliance between the Democratic and Republican Party stay solid and get rid of any third-party interlopers. We've all got to remain loyal to the system. And that's what they did. And, and that's why somebody else should be the candidate in the year 2004.
Absolutely, and we'll have a show on that too, and we'll clearly need to have you back. Make a wish, Daniel Sheehan. What would you like? How do you want to lob this into mainstream so that it's a discourse among everybody?
Well, I think that the most important thing to do is to really mount a major campaign. If you had to shake it down to the bottom line, they mm-hmm. need to mount a major campaign to insist that Senator John Kerry, the junior senator from Massachusetts that supervised the special select hearings on Iran-Contra, they need to insist that he be the nominee for the presidency in 2004. He wants to be the president unless he thinks that Bush has a good chance of being reelected again, at which point he'll step back and let Gore take the nomination and lose. But we've got to mount a major campaign, not because I think John Kerry is the king of the world, but he knows exactly what's going on. He's got to be the nominee for the Democratic Party. We've got to get a liberal Democratic candidate selected in 2004 so we can begin to mobilize a genuine progressive paradigm, a progressive alternative to the Republicans and Democrats, which we'll never be able to do until they get to have a liberal president in there.
We'll do it. We'll do it. We'll do it, Daniel Sheehan. Thank you so much. As guests, for a copy of this show, call 1-888-741-GODS, G-O-D-S. It's also where you can make reservations for Winter Solstice Gathering, where we'll gather force for exactly this, to have an egalitarian actual society, democracy. Thanks always to Sally Phillips, producer, and D.C. engineer Andy York, and always to Jim Bennett, Shadow World Governor for Betterment of All Creation, and Berkeley Board Op wonderful Lisa Ballard, and to the wild blooming of the disobedient, compassionate trickster heart stirring within all of us. Let's go out and be woofy and informed and creative. I'm Caroline Casey. We'll convene again next week.